Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and I am here with the one and only James Pennebaker. James has been a career musician for a long time. Right now, he's out on the road with Grammy-winning blues Americana artist Delbert McClinton. James is a multi-instrumentalist. He plays electric and acoustic guitar, violin and fiddle, which is really cool, mandolin and pedal and lap steel guitar. He's got 42 years of touring and recording experience with a discography of over 185 albums that includes a Grammy Award winner and several Grammy nominations. Recording and album credits include Delbert McClinton, Bonnie Bramlett, Pam Tillis, Leroy Parnell, Charlie Daniels, Freddie Fender, Flaco Jimenez, Big and Rich, and Kinky Friedman. Touring and performing credits include Delbert again, John Fogerty, Bonnie Raitt, Levon Helm and the Muscle Shoals All-Stars, Chris Christopherson, and Willie Nelson. Well, let me ask you this. You've had a really successful career, and I was curious, James, how this musical journey started for you, and how'd you wind up getting to Nashville?
Well, I mean, I could go back to the beginning, sort of, or I could skip ahead and tell you how I got to Nashville. But I started playing the violin when I was about 8 years old in the public school systems in Fort Worth, Texas. Hmm. Back in those days, every public school had a music program.
Yep.
And they had an orchestra and they had a band. And I had discovered that my dad, I found a little three-quarter violin in the closet of my mom and dad's bedroom one day when I was maybe 6, 7 years old. And come to find out it was my dad's, and he played the violin. And I had no idea, and I wanted to be like Pop. So I said, well, I want to learn to play the violin. And they set me up with lessons and started doing that and was trained, through the school system. And I had a private teacher and was being trained, you know, as a legitimate musician, classical music and all that stuff. And then here comes the old cliche of, I believe it was February 9th, 1964. The Beatles were on Ed Sullivan.
Uh-huh. You know how many, I would say, of guitar...
Everybody.
Yeah, that changed, like, everybody's life.
That, everybody.
That was a teenager.
My generation of people, you know, of a certain age. Absolutely. And I... my sisters, I have two older sisters, they had Beatle records in the house. I wasn't allowed to have my own Beatle records. My parents didn't think I was old enough. And of course, they were very dangerous with their long hair. But I remember watching them on their first Ed Sullivan show in the Den with my entire family, my mom, dad, my two sisters. And I immediately knew, well, that's a good job. Well, that's it. That's for me right there.
Hmm.
And I was about to say something to that effect, and then my father stood up out of his reclining chair and pointed at the TV and said, that is a communist plot to overthrow our government.
Wow.
Now, my father was a great man, and he was a Navy officer in World War II. He was a Navy hero. But I knew right then there was trouble ahead. You know what I mean?
That was a communist plot to overthrow America. Wow.
That's what he thought about the Beatles, yes. Now, Dad mellowed out as the years went on. But anyway, you know, seeing the Beatles was obviously – a life-altering experience. And, of course, then I wanted a guitar. I didn't want to give up playing the violin, but I also wanted a guitar. And my parents got me a little Japanese. You know, I had no idea of knowing what it was, and I still don't know what it was. Some kind of a Matsumoku-made Japanese guitar. Taisko, maybe. It had no name on it. And I took lessons from a gentleman named Dale Woodward there in Fort Worth. It was a classroom type situation, and they wanted to teach us Michael Row the Boat Ashore and things like that.
And you're wanting to play I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Exactly. Those of us in the class were going, wait a minute, we want to play I Want to Hold Your Hand, and we want to play Roll Over Beethoven. Mm-hmm. And bless his heart, Mr. Woodward, who happened to be a neighbor of ours. He lived down the street from me and my family. He said, no, 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 we're not teaching that rock and roll stuff, you know. And so subsequently, after maybe several weeks, I told my parents that, you know, I didn't really want to continue with my guitar lessons. And I pretty much was self-taught from there on the guitar. Continued my violin studies into college. Went to college as a violin major for about a year and a half.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to, at the time it was called North Texas State University.
Right.
It's now called the University of North Texas. And they're mainly known for their jazz program, still
yeah.
are.
Yeah, yeah.
And back in those days, the 1 o'clock lab band under Leon Breeden, Professor Breeden, they were, they were untouchable. And it was a great music school, and they had a wonderful classical program. And if you were going to go to a great music school in that part of the country, that was it. So that's where I went. But I discovered pretty quickly that with a degree as a violin major, I got two choices. Playing a symphony and teach. Mm. And probably need to do both.
Sure.
You know, to make a living. And that was not something that appealed to me. I was already, by the time I was maybe a junior in high school, sophomore or junior, I was discovering, you know, growing up in Texas, it's a melting pot of yeah. all kinds of music. I was discovering Bob Wills. Mm-hmm. And Western thing, and starting to fool around with improvising on the violin, which to a lot of my classmates, some teachers, but not my private teacher, she was really into it. It's like, what are you doing? How do you do that? It's not written on the paper. You know, how are you, what, you know, making up? And I was just improvising, you know. Playing something that just came out of my head, and it was really wild because a lot of the people, if it wasn't written on the page in front of them, they couldn't do that. So I started getting acquainted with some older musicians that were playing in the clubs around Fort Worth, and I started playing beer joints underage.
There's no way your mom and dad, or at least your dad, knew about this, though, right?
They didn't know much about it.
Yeah, I wouldn't think.
you know, I was driving age by
okay.
this time.
Okay.
So I would drive myself to the gigs. Not like, you know, I had to ask them to take me, because mm-hmm. they probably would not
sure.
have done that. And no, I didn't really tell them. And I had a little band in high school, besides the going out and playing Western Swing with some of the older guys. Some of my classmates and I, we had a little band in high school, and this is back during there was a progressive country movement going on in Texas back in the mid-70s. Willie had just moved back to Austin mm-hmm. with the whole Willie Waylon thing. And we had a band in high school that did that kind of stuff in the contest. And so we were playing some clubs around town, too, with our parents' blessing, because that was kind of, you know, we won the high school talent contest. So, you know, it was cool. It was kind of innocent. So we were doing that, too. But Fort Worth. And not just Fort Worth, Texas in general is such a melting pot of all kinds of music You know, when I first started playing clubs, it was the Western Swing. And it was honky-tonk country music like Ray Price and old Willie Nelson. Johnny Bush was a big thing there. Freddie Fender was a big thing at the time. And matter of fact, my first real master recording session was getting to play violin on a Freddie Fender record back in 77. But I started playing the clubs around Texas, and you had to play everything. And you had to make people dance. If people didn't dance, you weren't going to get hired back.
Sure.
And that...
Funny, now you got to make them drink.
And, you know, all those clubs where we grew up cutting our teeth, you know, they don't exist anymore anywhere.
Sure.
But, back in Texas, you know, I even played, you know, a couple places out in West Texas where this is, you know, you read about this and you go, oh, that didn't really happen. There's chicken wire in front of the bandstand.
You're kidding, like in the Blues Brothers.
Absolutely.
Holy shit. So wait a minute. Were people getting like really hammered and out of control and throwing stuff there, or just like what was the?
Well, yeah, some people would get hammered, but a lot of people would throw stuff just because they knew they could, because the chicken wire was there. You know what I mean?
Wow.
And they knew they weren't going to probably hurt anybody. But yeah, people.
Holy crap. Wait a minute. I can't even. I'm having a hard time just processing that. That's really weird.
No, that really existed. And maybe somewhere it still does. I hope not. But yeah.
That's amazing, man.
You know, the Blues Brothers movie thing, they didn't just make that up. That really went on. And I didn't play a lot of places like that, maybe a couple.
Hmm.
And I was scared to death.
Yeah, who the hell wouldn't be? You're a young kid, especially at the time.
I was playing with a lot of older guys, and they were like, oh, man, you ought to be okay, you know. But anyway, I did a lot of that kind of stuff. And, well, I'll go ahead and talk about when I got introduced to Delbert. I was playing in some of these progressive country kind of groups around Fort Worth, Dallas area. Delbert and there's a guy named Glenn Clark. They had made a couple of records out in California under the name of Delbert and Glenn. And they came out on Atlantic, a subsidiary of Atlantic Records. And they, you know, they weren't big sellers, but they kind of created a buzz in the, you know, kind of hippy-dippy, you know, the musical community. Hmm. Bonnie Raitt was a big fan of Delbert and Glenn. Going back to Bonnie. And anyway, it eventually fizzled out, and they came back to Fort Worth. And Delbert started coming out and kind of sitting in with this group I was playing with.
And what was he playing?
Delbert was playing mostly just singing and playing harmonica.
Okay.
You know, Delbert is known as one of the greatest harmonica players, blues harmonica players out there. Going back to Hey Baby and all that. And at the time, Delbert had just come back from Nashville from cutting his first solo record. And he needed a band to go out and play some dates to promote this record. So he hired this band that I was playing with some other Fort Worth musicians. And we went out for maybe 4 or 5 months and promoted this Delbert's first solo record. Again, I was playing fiddle. They were trying to market Delbert into this progressive country Texas thing, which really is not what Delbert is. He's a blues. He's more of a blues. Well, he's a blues man. He's a blues guy. But anyway, that's how they were marketing him. And we did the little tour. It lasted 4 or 5 months maybe. And then that was the end of that. And I subsequently from there went on and joined a house band in a club called Dewey Groom's Longhorn Ballroom in Dallas. And it was built in the 1940s for Bob Wills as Bob Wills' ranch house. Wow. And Bob Wills had sold it sometime in the 50s, I guess, to Jack Ruby.
Jack Ruby, the
Jack Ruby.
Holy right. shit.
And Dewey Groom, after Jack Ruby shot Lee Harvey Oswald and wound up in jail, Dewey Groom purchased it. And Dewey had a big 16-piece Western swing band in there for many years. And in the 70s, when Top 40 Country was pretty popular, I went to work. I had left the Delbert thing, and I went to work there playing fiddle and guitar for about 3 years. And they brought in every top country band, country act in the country on the weekends. Everybody from Merle Haggard to George Jones to Conway Twitty to you name them.
So you got great training there.
I got a wonderful education.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
And being in the house band, whenever these national acts would come through, we would play a set. They would always do two shows. We would play our little set. They'd come on, do their first show, and we'd play our second set, and they'd do their second show. And the other thing about the Longhorn, which was fascinating to me, is we work 5 nights a week. And on Monday nights, we were off. Monday and Tuesday nights, we were off. On Monday night, there was a black promoter in Dallas, and I can't think of his name to save my life. But he leased the building out from Dewey Groom on Monday nights and booked in B.B. King, Bobby Bland, Joe
Holy
Tech,
crap.
Little Johnny Taylor, Lowell Fulsom, you know, you name it. And there were many nights where Dewey would come to us every Sunday night when we finished our week. We'd be in Dewey's office to get paid, and he'd crack a bottle of, you know, Jack Daniels or whatever and be passing around. He goes, "Well, boys, we got B.B. King in here tomorrow night, and I don't have anybody to run sound." And my hand would go up.
Yeah.
And they had a little Peavey 8-channel board with the big stove knob. Not even faders, you know. And my hand would go up, and I said, "Man, I'm in." So I got to see B.B. and all the Joe Tex, Al Green, Bobby Bland, you name it. I got to see him in there. And sometimes I ran sound for him. And so that was a big education for me. Also, growing up around there, I got to see Freddie King all the time. I know you recently interviewed Leroy, and Leroy talked about that too. But Freddie he played the Motherlode in Fort Worth, Mother Blues in Dallas. First time I saw him was at an old movie theater called the Palace Theater in downtown Fort Worth. And there were all these bands out of Fort Worth, rock bands like Blood Rock and Nitzinger, Bugs Henderson, I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes.
Bugs was a big influence on me. And later on, we got to be good friends. But a lot of these guys, a lot of those rock bands, they would do these festivals or these little shows in these theaters and clubs. And they would open up for Freddie King.
Wow.
Because Freddie was kind of the blues hero of DFW. And seeing Freddie King really turned my head around and made me go, okay, I want to be a guitar player. You know, so Freddie King was a big influence. And from there, back in 1979, I went back on the road with Delbert playing guitar this time. And he had just cut a record on Capricorn called Keeper of the Flame. And And we did Saturday Night Live and a lot of the big TV shows like that. Maybe a year or so later, year and a half later, Capricorn folded and Delbert got signed to Capitol Records through Muscle Shoals Sound down in Muscle Shoals. And he had his biggest hit, Giving It Up For Your Love. Yeah, we did that. And then the next year or so, Delbert changed labels. And his biggest hit, Giving It Up Your Love, was released. And that was a really great thing for him and really great thing for the band. We did, you know, we were on the road all the time. And we were young. We were in our early 20s. I was in my early 20s. Delbert's a little bit older than I am. But and I was always the youngest guy in the band. But that was a wonderful time, and I stayed with Delbert during that period through about 1986, and, you know, as a guitar player.
Were you still doing utility stuff as well, like fiddle? And
I was still doing utility stuff back in Fort Worth when I wasn't on the road with Delbert.
Okay.
I would do, you know, the occasional – well, I did a lot of jingle sessions back in those days when I was home.
That's great.
You know, everything from Poulon or Poulon, however you say it, chainsaws to, you know, Taco Bell. I was doing stuff like that. So, yeah, I was still doing other instruments somewhat, but not much. And at that point, I had pretty much decided – I'm going to let this other stuff go by the wayside. I just want to play guitar.
Hmm.
You know.
And how did that wind up taking you to Nashville?
Well, okay. I'll skip ahead just a little bit. I left Delbert in 76. My second son, we were pregnant with my second son. And my oldest son was 9 years old, almost 9 years old. And I'd been pretty much gone the entire time. And I made up my mind, I'm not going to miss this one. So I left Delbert and I went to work for a guitar manufacturing company in Fort Worth that, at the time, owned, you probably heard of Jackson Charvel Guitars.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So I went to work for them. And I did that until the early 90s. And I did very well in that company. And, of course, all the time I was still playing weekends around Fort Worth, Dallas. But Leroy Parnell, he and I first met when we were probably 17 years old. In some club in Fort Worth. He grew up in Stephenville, which is about 60 miles southwest of Fort Worth. And I, of course, grew up in Fort Worth. Well, if you're from Stephenville and you want to go to the big city, you go to Fort Worth. So when Leroy graduated from school, or maybe he dropped out, I honestly don't know.
Sure.
But anyway, he wound up in Fort Worth playing in bands, and we met each other. And to cut to the chase, about 1990, 89 or 90, Delbert and his wife, Wendy, invited my wife and I up to Nashville. Delbert had moved to Nashville in about 1987.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He left Fort Worth and moved to Nashville. We came up and spent Thanksgiving with them. And, of course, I gave Leroy a call just to say hello to my old buddy. And he said, hey, I'm playing the Grand Ole Opry tonight. Why don't you come play it with me?
Wow.
I was kind of like, wait a minute, excuse me? What song? You know, he goes, oh, it's a song I got on the radio right now. He goes, it's real easy. You don't even need to hear it. He said, they'll have an acoustic guitar there. We'll find somebody with an acoustic guitar, and you just strum acoustic guitar, and you get to play on the Opry. And I was like, well, okay. So I went and did that. And I don't think I did very well.
That's the universe like really lining up for you.
Yeah, it was a wonderful thing. And I mean, I walked out of there and went, wow, I played on the Grand Ole Opry. I don't know what I was doing, you know.
But I'm on your visit to Nashville. It's not even like you're a working musician here.
Exactly. And Leroy said to me, you know, he said, you know, I want to put my dream band would be Reese Winans on keyboards, you on guitar. He goes, I've already got a drummer and a bass player, Lynn Williams and Steve Mackey. He says, but what would it take to get you up here and be in my band? And I told him a figure, which was basically the figure I was making for the guitar company back in Fort Worth. And he said, well, I can't really do that right now. But when I can, I'm going to call you. And I thanked him, and I thought, you know, part of me thought, well, golly, this is great. But at the same time, a part of me thought, well, you know, not to say that talk is cheap, but, you know, we'll see.
Yeah.
You know.
Sure.
I know Leroy. I love him. He's my brother from another mother. And I know he means well, but, you know. We'll just see. Mm. Well, about a year and a half later, I was sitting at my desk in my little office at the guitar company in Fort Worth, and the phone rang. And it was Leroy. And I'd been keeping up with, you know, the radio, top 40 country radio, and he'd had some more hits, and it was Leroy. And he said, you know that number you told me a couple years ago? And I said, yeah. And he goes, does that still work for you? I said, yeah. And he said, well, when can you start?
Wow.
And I kind of said, well, let me go upstairs and give my 2-week notice.
Good for you.
And my wife and I had been, we had been trying to figure out how to get to Nashville for several years. Even when we went up and had Thanksgiving with Delbert and Wendy, we already knew that's where we wanted to go.
You felt comfortable there.
And by this time, I was in my mid-30s, and I had gone as far as I could go in Fort Worth. And everybody that I knew in the music business in Fort Worth, they pretty much left. Hmm. To go on to bigger things, you know, to Nashville or LA. Or I just felt like, well, this is my shot. If I'm going to take it, I better take it now. If I don't take it, I'll regret it for the rest of my life. You know, so I moved up to Nashville to work with Leroy, and that lasted, well, it was 1993 when we moved, and that lasted to close to 99, close to 2000. Leroy, unfortunately, got dropped by his label. By that time, he had had a good run. You know, he had had 7 years of a few number ones and several top 10 records. But everybody has a shelf life, you know.
Hmm.
And things kind of splintered with Leroy. And I went on to work with Pam Tillis for a few years.
Was Jeff King working with her then?
Jeff was not in the band when I was, no. And I remember earlier than that, back in the 90s when I was with Leroy, Bob Britt was with Pam.
Mm.
So I had known a lot of people that had worked with Pam and knew her a little bit. Matter of fact, Leroy and Pam shared the same management company and were on the same record label in Nashville. So, you know, that probably had something to do with me kind of segueing into Pam's camp, and had a real good 3 years with her. I had a tour. I went on tour with John Fogerty in 2009 for about 4 or 5 months.
How did that come about?
Well, that came about I was working for Fender Musical Instruments at that time, doing artist relations, and wasn't particularly happy doing that because it didn't allow me very much time to be a musician. But I got a call out of the blue. A friend of mine named Jason Mowry, who's a wonderful fiddle player, mandolin player, dobra player, one of these guys that plays everything, plays guitar too. He had been working for John for a couple of years, and John had recorded a record called Return of the Blue Ridge Rangers. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was just the Blue Ridge Rangers.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah, John's first solo record after Creedence was called the Blue Ridge Rangers. He didn't even call it John Fogerty. And this was kind of a revisit of that record in 2009. And Jason had played all the fiddle on it, and John was going to go out and do a couple months tour to promote it. And Jason referred me. They needed Greg Lees had played steel on the record, but he couldn't do the tour. And so Jason said, "Well, I know a guy that plays steel and fiddle and mandolin and guitar and blah blah blah." So anyway, I got the call. John called me and basically hired me over the phone. I didn't have to audition or anything. I was lucky.
Well, I'll tell you, it's interesting because, you know, you started off playing fiddle, and I bet at a certain point in time you might have even said to yourself, "Man, I've spent all this time playing fiddle, and it's been wasted. I should have been only focusing on guitar." And
you're exactly right.
Yeah, And in reality, that has probably been one of the things that's kept you steadily employed, because you're such a you have this ability to pick up a fiddle and to pick up a mandolin and a pedal steel and do all these things.
Yeah, you know, I read something recently. It was a quote by Jason Isbell. Hmm. And, of course, you know, he was talking about his songwriting thing. He says, "Well, I figured out early on that if I was just going to be a guitar player, I wasn't going to get very far." And he was referring to songwriting.
Sure.
You know. But I kind of figured out early on, if I was just going to be a fiddle player, I wasn't going to get very far.
Sure.
And I was fascinated by the pedal steel. And so I took that up. And I still consider myself just a hobbyist on that instrument, but people call me to do it. But primarily, I consider myself a guitar player. That's what I would rather do.
Sure.
You know, and I have to go back to the Beatles thing.
Right.
You know, that's when I said, "That's it. I want to be a guitar player. You know, I want to rock. I want to rock and roll."
Sure, man.
I mean, it's silly that sounds as that might sound now when we're in our 60s. And I always loved the blues. You know, when I was in high school, we'd come home from school and we'd go down to our neighbor's house. And we would listen to Led Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix and maybe some Jethro Tull and stuff like that. And as soon as their dad got home from work, we were out the back door. We had to go home because
of all the communists.
Yes, yeah, right. You know, moms and dads didn't always approve of that stuff back then. But that's what we were into. And so I wanted to be a guitar player, you know.
Quick question for you. You meant about Freddie. When you were seeing Freddie play, was he over on his 345 by then, or was he still playing his lessons?
No, he was playing the 345. This would have been about 1971 or 2 when I first saw him. And I went to see, it was a concert. You know who Blood Rock is?
No, I've heard the Blood name. Rock, I'd be lying if I said I know.
Blood Rock was a rock band, and they sold millions of records out of Fort Worth. They toured a lot with Grand Funk Railroad back in that time period. Their producer was Terry Knight, same as Grand Funk. Anyway, Grand Funk eventually broke up. And the guitar player for Grand Funk, his name was Lee Pickens. He was a great guitar player, and he was very much influenced by a guy named Ray Sharp, who was from Fort Worth, who was a black guitar player, had a big hit in 1962 called Linda Lou. And if you've never heard of Linda Lou, you need to go search it out.
Yeah, I just wrote it down.
It's a big hit record, and Ray was from Fort Worth. He did all the Dick Clark review shows back in the early 60s, you know, with everybody, Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee. Ray had this big hit, Linda Lou. Well, anyway, Lee Pickens winds up with this rock band, you know, Blood Rock. But Lee played like Ray Sharp. Well, after Blood Rock split, Capitol signed Lee to a solo deal, and it was a Lee Pickens group. So I went to see the Lee Pickens group at the Palace Theater in Fort Worth because I was a Blood Rock fan. And they'd split up, and I was a fan of Lee, so I went to see Lee's. I didn't know who this Freddie King guy was. Didn't even know he was going to be there.
Oh, interesting.
And here comes this opener, Freddie King. And he was the largest black man I'd ever seen.
Yeah, he was massive, wasn't he?
Scared the living daylights out of me.
Because he had that big-ass guitar, and it looked like a little...
Yeah, 345 looked like a mandolin.
Yeah.
On him. I had never seen anything like it in my life, and really haven't since. I mean, that first impression. And it turned my head around so bad that I just went, well, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's it right there.
Yeah.
And, of course, I was familiar with B.B. and Albert by then, but I didn't know who Freddie was. And there he was right in my own backyard from Dallas. But I was just a punk high school kid. I didn't know. And I proceeded to go see him wherever I could after that. He played clubs all over Fort Worth and Dallas when he wasn't, you know, touring. Mother Blues in Dallas, I saw him over there. There was a club in Fort Worth called the Mother Lode he used to play. And I ended up having some good friends of mine now, a gentleman named Louis Stevens, who was 19 or 20 back then, and the only white kid in the band. He played piano for Freddie. And Louis is still active in Fort Worth. And yeah, but Freddie King really was an eye-opener for me, huge eye-opener, as was Delbert. Delbert really opened my eyes to the blues, too.
For me, Freddie has the best tone of almost – I mean, just for me personally, I mean, there's a lot of great tone guys, Leslie West, tons of them, but I always loved what he does, and he picks that guitar up, gets right to my heart and soul like nobody else. Yeah, he's a pretty phenomenal guy.
Yeah, he definitely goes for the jugular.
Yes. Yeah, and then when you watch him, how he's so unconventional with his finger picks,
mm-hmm.
and the way it's even his physical, you know, he's like attacking the guitar.
Yeah, he played with a thumb pick and a metal finger pick on his index finger.
Correct, and a lot of people attribute his tone, his unique tone, to that.
Well, there's probably a lot to that.
Yeah, and apparently he. I don't know if this is true, you know, who knows, because this is, you know, quite a while later. You're reading on the internet that he wore the thumb pick up, excuse me, not the thumb, his finger pick upside down or something like that. I don't know.
You know, I've heard that too.
Yeah.
I'd have to go back and look at some old videos and check that out. And fortunately, there's a lot of Freddie King stuff on.
Yeah.
Video out now.
Yeah, there really is. I've enjoyed
it. There used to not be. Yeah.
Let me ask you this, James. You've had a long career, and I was wondering, you know, we all make mistakes and pay tuition, quote unquote, in our businesses. And I was wondering if you'd be kind enough to maybe share one or two mistakes you made along the journey, and what were the lessons that you learned? Because one thing comes through loud and clear. Almost all of your gigs have been really long term. So you're doing a lot of stuff right. You know, you don't get to stick around 9 years, 5 years, 3 years.
Yeah.
That's not random luck.
I guess not.
Well, it's not. You know, 6 months, yeah. 9 years, 3 years, 5 years, no.
Yeah. I think I can kind of honestly say I'm loyal to the people I work with. Well, let me phrase that differently. I've been fortunate in that the people that I have worked with, for the most part, are dear friends of mine, like Delbert, right. Leroy. So it's not like you're working for some boss necessarily. You're working for your brother. It's like family.
Yeah.
But to go back to your question about, you're talking about pitfalls?
Well, just mistakes that you might have made.
Mistakes?
Yeah, you know, like certain things, like some players I've interviewed have said, you know, actually Leroy, I think if I remember, said, you know, I went to a gig one time, I thought I was all that, didn't prepare, didn't get the gig, should have gotten it, and that was the first and last time that ever happened.
Yeah, well, I could tell a story kind of like that. This was back during the time period where I was really trying to get up here in Nashville. Delbert had moved here. Everybody I'd known had moved here. And I was kind of the last bastion holdout. And I got a call. I was at a NAMM show. I was working for the Jackson Charvel company. I got a call at a NAMM show from the musical director for Brooks and Dunn, who were a huge country act back in the 90s. And I was never a big fan of theirs, but this was an opportunity to possibly get a job and get to Nashville and then go from there. And the guy said, well, we need a fiddle player, and we've heard about you from Delbert McClinton and this guy and this guy and this guy and all these people up here say you're so great, and we're looking at you. We'd like you to come up here. And says, we're only looking at one other guy. And I said, well, yeah, I'll do it. And I arranged to take some time off from my day job. And I drove all the way from Fort Worth, 12 hours to Nashville, and stayed at Delbert's house and talked to the guy, touched base with him again when I got there. He said, yeah, well, you know, it's just you and one other guy. We'll see you tomorrow. You need to be there about 2 o'clock in the afternoon at a rehearsal complex. And so I got there and there must have been 75 other fiddle players.
You're lined kidding. Up in the hall.
No, it was a cattle call. And wouldn't you know, they called me in last, and I literally hung out there for probably 4.5-5 hours until it became my turn. And I came in there last, and I remember Ronnie Dunn going, man, I've been having all these famous people call my house telling me how great you are. And I thought to myself, oh, Lord, I'm in big trouble. And anyway, I did the audition. They said, well, the road manager will give everybody a phone call later on this evening. And then I went back to Delbert's and I got the phone call, and I didn't get the job. They hired somebody else. So I drove back to Fort Worth.
Oh.
That was a long 12-hour drive with my tail between my legs. And does that answer the question?
But what do you think you could have done differently? How did you make a mistake?
Not
there?
A thing.
Yeah, you didn't make any mistakes there. That was kind of weird that they told everybody there's only.
It was not presented to me exactly like it turned out.
Yeah, that was rude.
But that doesn't mean I would have gotten the job anyway. though, yeah, necessarily, you know. And but that was my, that was a very good education for me into Nashville and what it's like up here, because there are so many fantastic musicians up here.
Sure.
That it's, you know, you just don't come up here and make it. You just don't come up here and get a gig. You come up here and you might hang around up here for 5 years before you get that phone call. And then you better deliver, because there's just so many world-class players up here.
Mm.
And I've, you know, I'm fortunate that I've been able to get jobs up here with people that I know, and they hire me because they want me to do what I do. When I go and audition, and I've auditioned for about, I've had about three auditions up here, and I've been up here 25 years. I've never gotten a job from an audition.
Interesting.
I've gotten a job because it was somebody that knew me and wanted me for what I do, whatever that is. It's sure. It's a little bit of the Texas thing, I guess. It's a utility man thing. I've got a lot of jobs for being able to play multiple instruments. But it's tough up here, you know. I remember friends of mine early on who had been up here long before I came up here said, well, you just got to come up here and you figure it's going to take you 5 years. I don't care who you know or how good you are, 5 years before you probably land something substantial. You know? And that's not true with everybody, but that's what it used to be.
Sure. But you came up here, you had some connections, which helped you
out. I did.
Yeah,
I had a job when I came
up.
And that was
that's really huge. Well, plus you knew some substantial people. You knew Leroy, you knew Delbert, you knew people that were inviting and supportive of you. And
very
so,
true.
Yeah, that
very
made your...
True. And I was very fortunate.
Yeah, yeah.
If I had come up here totally on my own, not knowing a soul, I might not have lasted a month.
Sure. Sure. Well, especially because you had a couple of kids when you came. It's not like you were, a, you know, 19-year-old
yeah,
kid.
But I've always had kids. And I've always been a musician. And, you know, I'm blessed with a wife who supports me. And she's made sure that she takes care of the kids while I'm not in town. You know, I don't, you know. Like I say, I've always had kids, and I've always been a musician. And
how long
I've
you
always?
Been... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I say I've always tried to be the best father I could be, but I've been absentee a lot.
You have two sons, you said?
I have two sons and a stepdaughter. Yes.
How long have you been married?
It'd be 42 years this September.
Holy shit!
I have three granddaughters now.
Man,
too.
Congratulations!
Well, thank you.
That's a long time.
Yes, it is.
Wow. So for people...
I don't like to talk about it because it gives away my age.
What's that? It gives away your age?
Yeah.
You talked about seeing it's something in 1969. That gave away your age, man.
Well, yeah.
Playing professionally, you weren't...
Yeah,
you,
when I
you
was
weren't,
in junior...
You weren't six.
I was in junior high school in 1969.
What so what's the secret, man? So people are listening to this, they're going to want to know what's the secret to having a, you know, because I've seen you on Facebook, your wife, you actually seem like you're happy, and you know, and you're not one of these guys. It's I always like, to me it's a red flag when everybody when you see people on social media and they go way out of their way to like rave about their spouse 24/7. That always means that shit is not working in the house, to me, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I've seen you on social media and you seem genuinely happy, you know, and very comfortable and secure and in love with your wife and your relationship. So what do you think's been some of the, cause I like, this show is about success to me in general. And to me, being married 42 years is a big successful thing. What's some of the...
I wish I had an easy answer for that.
Oh, there ain't no easy answer to 42 years, because it ain't easy every day. I know that, because I've been married 20. I've been with my wife 25.
God knows, I've done my share to grew it up, and I just got a good one. God was looking out for me, and we're best friends. We are best friends. We've always been best friends, you know, before anything else. And we, you know, believe me, it's not all.
Of course, sunshine and roses. Hell no.
No. Not, Lord, no.
Not by a long shot. That's not realistic. Anybody who says that. Come on, you can't be with someone 24/7 or even whatever time. That's not real. No, that's not realistic.
But I'll say this. I believe, and I believe this very strongly, and I've had this conversation with other musician friends and their wives too. And this probably goes more for in the earlier days of our marriage than it does now. Because, I mean, come on, after 42 years, it's kind of like, you know, but I mean, back in the early days, being gone on the road, and you would come home, I would come home, everything's fresh again.
Right.
It's like almost like another honeymoon, in a way.
Yeah, I can see
you
that.
You know?
Yep.
It really was. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. Hmm. I mean, I know that's a cliche, but it's very true. And it's still true now, even though I don't travel like we used to. I mean, back in the old days, we'd be gone 6-8 weeks at a time, come home for a couple of days, which is enough to do the laundry and then leave again.
Sure. And that's tough.
We don't do that anymore. We go out Thursday, Friday, Saturday and come home. You know, we're home more than we're gone. But I think that... you know, that was some of it. Absence makes the heart grow fonder, and I'm just blessed with the right woman. She supported me. She believes in what I'm doing, and that's kind of it. We also have faith. You know, we have God and we have Christ in our marriage, and that's a big part of it, too.
Well, congratulations to both of y'all.
Well, thank you.
That's really a major accomplishment. You have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
Not much. Right before you called, I was up here rewiring a Fender Esquire. that's kind of my hobby.
Guitars.
If I'm not playing them, I'm tweaking with them, messing with amplifiers. I don't have a whole lot of hobbies outside of music.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. What's your go-to guitar right now, and what other two guitars might round out your top three?
My go-to guitar is a Fender Telecaster. And it's a guitar that I've played for the last about 26 years. I have several other Telecasters. I'll pick up a Telecaster first. 9 times out of 10. I have more guitars than... It's ridiculous. And I'm getting to the age to where it's like, oh my God, what are my children going to do with all these instruments when I'm gone? But I'm pretty much a tele player. Mm. I like Strats too. I've got all kinds of Gibsons and Gretches and Rickenbackers and Dan Electros. And, you know, working in Nashville, doing sessions and stuff, you got to have something of everything.
You prefer vintage guitars over modern?
Yes, but I don't own that many vintage guitars anymore. There was a time when I never had more vintage guitars than newer guitars, but I used to have a lot more vintage instruments than I do now. I've got an old Strat. I've got a couple of old Gibson acoustics. I used to have a wonderful old 52 Telecaster. But honestly, the Telecaster I play now, for the past 25 or 6 years, Vince Canetto built it for me, and he was the first guy to start doing the relic guitars for Fender. Mm. And he was a Leroy fan, and he used to run around with us some. He was like, man, you're nuts for carrying that old 52 all over the world. I said, you're crazy. And he said, I'm going to build you something.
So he made you a Fender Custom?
He made me a Fender Custom, more of a clone of my 52 than anything. And it was a better guitar. And long story short, I ended up having to pay for a couple of my children's weddings. And I had to sell a 52.
Sure.
But the guitar that Vince had made me was a better guitar. And I was already playing it all the time. But I have all kinds of guitars, all kinds of amps, way too many.
Is there such a thing?
Yes.
Then you must really have too many.
I used to not think so. But as I'm getting older, I look around and I go, this is too many.
How about this, James? Is there anything like, if you can go back in time and do one thing differently, either business or personal, what would that one thing be?
Well, the one thing I might do different if I had to go do it all over again, that was a question?
Yes, sir.
Well, I would, I'm going to just come right out and say it here. I would, make a different decision about falling into some of the pitfalls that are out there, like drugs and alcohol.
Mm, gotcha. You partied a lot when you were a kid.
Partied a lot. Educate pretty much.
Broke up. I'm sorry.
You know, there's a fine line. I don't want to glamorize it at all.
Sure.
You know, there's a fine line between talking about it and glamorizing it. But, yeah, that would be the one thing I would do different.
Yeah. So you think you partied to excess at times that impacted some career opportunities? Or just general having your act together?
I don't think it affected any career opportunities. But, well, maybe it did years and years later. I don't know.
Sure.
It's just something to be aware of and not stay away from it. I mean, you know, I don't know what else quite to say about it other than, you know, and it was part of the time period when
sure.
I came up in the 1980s. It doesn't, you know, I don't see it now. I don't see it with young people in the music business now. I mean, I know it's out there.
Sure.
We have the opioid thing going on now, to where back in the 80s it was cocaine.
Cocaine, yeah, of course.
Yeah. And alcohol, of course, is always there.
Hmm.
And, you know, it got me. It got me, but I got away, you know, I cleaned up.
Good for you, man.
But stay away from it. It's not necessary.
If you're talking, there's a lot of guitar players obviously listen to this show. What would be one, without getting personal in your own life in any way, making you uncomfortable, but if you're advising some of these younger cats listening, other than stay away, what's a specific reason why they need to stay away?
Well, I want to be careful about how I answered that.
Yeah, please.
Because it will eventually, the tail will wag the dog eventually. In the beginning, you think it's working for you, and you think it's helping you. You think it's helping you be more creative, and it's helping you play better. But in the end, it turns on you. And I would say, if you think it's helping you play better, tape some of your shows, listen to them the next morning, and you'll probably find out that, that wasn't nearly as good as I thought it was.
Interesting. A guy I know went through recovery, and he said one of the things he learned was when you start using drugs, it's a solution to a problem you have. Maybe it helps you cope better. It helps you be more creative. And he says the problem is, within a short period of time, the solution to your problem becomes the new problem.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and that's what that reminds me of.
I was always, and still am, extremely introverted, shy. My self-esteem could be improved on a lot. And back in those days, it was worse. And the substance just made everything, made me come out of my shell.
Sure.
Made me put that lampshade on my head and be the life of the party and be comfortable. But after a while, you realize that it's working against you. And just don't do it.
You know, and I appreciate you being so transparent there. And for whatever it's worth, I've spoken to you several times, but I've never thought you're shy or introverted. So you're doing a good job on that end, man. I can tell you right now. I was surprised when you said that, to tell you the truth.
I'm pretty introverted guy.
Yeah, well, you've always been. I've always thought you. I thought you were really outgoing.
I should be.
Funny how that works. Sometimes we're our own worst critics too, you know.
That's true. That's very true.
A couple more questions today. What is your definition of happiness?
What is my definition of happiness today? To have gotten out of bed this morning and feel good and just be ready to face another day.
Nice. And last question, James. Over the last 10 years, what do you think your biggest change in your personality has been, and how much of this has been deliberate, meaning something you've worked on changing, and how much has just been a natural part of aging?
Over the last 10 years, and this would not be quite 10 years, this would be going on 6 years, the biggest change in my life has been having 3 grandchildren. And how much it has made me kind of reevaluate my life and just want to hang around, want to be here for them. And the other thing of it might be just in the last, well, this would be less than 10 years, I'm back to being a musician again, which is really fulfilling for me. I was working for the Fender Company for several years. It didn't allow me to pursue my musical career very much, and I've gotten away from that and gotten back into just being a musician full time, and that is a very fulfilling thing for me. This is what I'm happiest doing. This is what I feel like God put me here to do, is to be a musician.
Well, and you're doing it, man. You're on the road all the time now. Well, not on the time, but I know you're always out on the weekends.
Yeah, we're out, and we're fixing to go to kind of a new thing I'm about to embark on for a couple of weeks next month, going to the UK, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales on a farewell tour with the cast of the Nashville television show. So I'm looking forward to that.
That's cool, man.
Doing that as a utility guy, playing a bunch of different instruments. But
you ever been to the UK?
I have been to the UK. I haven't been to Ireland, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, Ireland. Everybody says Ireland's beautiful. Same with Scotland. I've been to England, but never Ireland or Scotland.
I have not been to Scotland either, but I've been to the UK. But so I'm looking forward to that. And going over there with one of my fellow Delbert bandmates. So we're looking forward to have fun and be over there for a couple of weeks, come back, get on the Delbert bus again.
Man, well, that's really good to hear, and I'm really happy for you. And I hope you guys come down this neck of the woods so we can sit down and have a cup of coffee in person, maybe.
How close are you to St. Pete's Beach or St. Pete's?
25, 30 minutes. You coming here? When are you coming to St. Pete?
We are going to be there.
Oh, you're at the Blues Festival, I think, right?
We're at the Blues Festival, like, pretty quick, I think.
Yeah, I think it's coming up soon.
The 8th of April.
I saw, you know, I think, is that Derek's festival? Does he run that?
I don't know who Derek is.
Derek Trucks?
Well, I don't know if he runs that festival or not.
I asked because he and Susan, you know, him and his wife are always headlining it. And I saw, I've told a story here, and I apologize for anybody listening, but it was such an impact. I don't mind telling it again. I saw Derek close out. They close out that show every year, and I was there about 3-4 years ago with my older son, and Derek played a Bob Dylan song as the encore called "Down in the Flood."
Yeah, oh, I know it well.
Okay, I have never
Dwayne played the guitar on Bob's original version of that.
Really?
Don't quote me.
That's something worth looking up.
So. I may be thinking about "Down Along the Cove."
Okay. And I'll tell you, man, what he did and the way he played in my entire life of seeing 100 shows or more, I never saw anybody do that with a guitar. And I literally couldn't speak after that. It was breathtaking. And I don't know how anybody played the guitar like that, man. And you know, he was playing slide, of course, but it was amazing. So that's a good – you're going to have a good time there, man. That's a good show.
Well, I can remember – this is probably, I don't know, very early 90s. I hadn't been with Leroy very long. And we played in Florida at some club. Maybe it was Ronnie Van Zant's widow's place, the Lynyrd Skynyrd Club down there. I don't remember. But he came out. He was 12 years old, maybe. Derek.
Yeah.
Came out. And, of course, you know, Leroy's a slide player. Mm. Came out and sat in with us and just proceeded to slice heads.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
Sure.
And Leroy was just like, oh my God.
Yeah. How is this even possible?
Right. This kid's 12 years old and I got to follow that.
Yeah.
You know.
I know.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty intense.
But we'll be at the St. Pete's Blues Festival or whatever it is. I'm going to the. I got to go to Delbert.com to see where I'm going to be.
Well, let me wrap this up and we'll catch up on this afterwards. I want to tell people where to find you. You can see James Pennebaker on the road with Delbert. So go to Delbert.com He's been with Delbert since 1979, on and off. So they have a great chemistry going. They have a great band. Bob Britt is also a guitar player and a music director there. I interviewed Bob several episodes back, and it's a good time. So I interviewed Rob McNally, who's played with Delbert, and
absolutely.
Rob said that gig pretty much saved his musical career and gave him faith in playing guitar again for the same reason you mentioned. It's blues, Americana. It's great music. And so everybody check out Delbert on the Road and say hi to James when you see him. Man, I can't thank you enough for your time and for being so open and transparent and overcoming. You're definitely overcoming your shy and introverted for at least this last hour and 13 minutes. So,
well, good. Maybe this will help.
This will help. Yeah, we're all about helping here. James, thank you so much for your time, and I really do appreciate everything.
Thank you, Craig.
Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks very much again to James Pennebaker for spending time with us. And you can look James up online and on YouTube as well as some stuff there. His last name is spelled Pennebaker, P-E-N-N-E-B-A-K-E-R. And go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes along with some cool stuff we got going on for guitar players. Be nice. Go play a guitar and have some fun. Till next time, yeah. Peace and love, everybody. And I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.